Welcome to the Passport Play Podcast with Jonathan Lord. This episode's guest, Rich Cohen, is the co-creator of HBO's Vinyl and the author of the new book, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. What's really inside Keith Richards' black doctor's bag?
I don't know, man. I never actually looked in there. I always imagined it like the thing in Pulp Fiction with the briefcase where he opens it up and it glows. You know,
yeah.
It was like it seemed like probably if you looked in, it would have no bottom. It would defy the laws of physics or something. But he was always poking around in it, offering stuff from it. But I never actually got a hold of it and looked inside of it. And if I was a better reporter, maybe I would have done that.
The soul of Marcellus Wallace from Pulp Fiction is in Keith Richards'
exactly.
Doctor's bag. Well, I was going to ask you about the. As a reporter and a fan of the Rolling Stones, I don't know how you did it, but how did you maintain your objectivity throughout writing this book? It must have been really, really hard for you to keep those spheres of influence separated.
I don't know. I don't really worry about being objective. You know, I'm just completely writing from my experience and my point of view, and I try to be honest and tell the truth as much as I see it. And that sometimes means circling around and struggling with things and changing your opinion, and I just like try to show all of that struggle on the page. It's just kind of what I'm interested in, like writing wise. So I think objectivity, while important in a newspaper, it's basically an unrealistic, you know, it's like absolute zero. You can't really get there. So for me, the kind of stuff I write, the best is to just lay everything out there and let you know exactly who I am and who you're hearing from, and then you can make up your own mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but what's interesting is you reference this in your book, and when you were starting off at Rolling Stone, you had an editor who I think called you into the office and basically said, you know, what do you like doing? Who do you like listening to? And you had it in your mind that you wanted to do something on the Stones maybe at some point. So you intentionally told them that you know, you didn't say you weren't a Stones fan, but you listed other bands. I think you said you listed Bruce Springsteen. So clearly. Other people think that, you know, in order to perhaps chronicle the history of a rock and roll band, you might have to not necessarily be a fan.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I guess that was true then, and that was you know, Rolling Stone magazine. It was a slightly different job, but I think, you know, look, the magazine's called Rolling Stone, so how objective can it really be? You know what I mean? I mean, the magazine is completely made by that music. So, you know, there's some things that are, it's like the sun and the moon and the Rolling Stones. You can't really be objective about the sun, and you can't really be objective about the moon, you know, your feelings about it. And you can't really be objective about Ronald Reagan if you grew up in the 1980s. And you can't really be objective about the Rolling Stones. You just try to be honest. And I think what they didn't want was somebody who was like, you know, a fan to the point where you couldn't do your job. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And basically, at that point in my life, I was more interested in doing a good job as a writer than as being a fan of the Rolling Stones. So actually, I was on the straight and narrow because it was a huge career opportunity for me because it was a big cover story for Rolling Stone, the first time I'd ever been given an assignment that big. So I was really worried about doing a good job, often to the point where, you know, I kind of never stepped back for many years and said, wow, look at this experience that I'm having. I kind of didn't enjoy it while it was happening. And probably that was, you know, that's probably the right way to go in as a writer, although maybe not necessarily the funnest way to go in as a human being.
And maybe it helps that, and you said this in your book, that you were perhaps born a little too late to catch the Stones at their apex, and we can get into the golden run, which you talked at length about in the book. But when you started covering the Stones in 1994, you were what? Just a kid, right? 24, 25, 26. And so at that point, you experienced their music through, I think it was your older brother, right? So your introduction through to the Stones came from someone else, and I wonder if that helped keep them at a distance as a fan.
Well, first of all, I think that younger brothers, if you have older siblings, those are the people that tend to have the coolest taste in music because, you know, I remember my my one of my best friends had no older siblings, and his favorite song was "The Streak" or "It's Hard to Be Humble," you know. Whereas I was listening, I'm talking about like fifth grade. I was listening to like the Stones and to Lou Reed, and I didn't even know what those songs meant, but I knew it was, I knew they were cool. So I think that is the perspective of the whole book, which is kind of the human condition, which is belatedness and this feeling that you arrived at the party, but you arrived as the party was ending. You arrived too late. And that is the perspective of the whole book, I think, and that is my feeling about rock and roll, too, which is we got great rock and roll, but we got the tail end of it as it was ending. And it's an advantage, I think, because there's like an ability, if you can, if you're around at the end of the day, then you can kind of tell, you see the whole thing. You know, wasn't a lot of the earlier Stones books that were really good were really kind of Rolling Stone writers, a lot of them reporting from the road, you know, in the middle of the action, cinema verite or something. This is afterward, postscript, you know, the whole story, because you've lived through the whole thing and seen it end, kind of, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I think that that perspective certainly helps people like myself who are, you know, I'm certainly too young to, you know, I'm 37 years old, so I couldn't claim the Stones as my own. But my dad certainly does. And you know, he lived through their apex, through everything. And it's hard to hear him talk about it because I lack the context he does. And, you know, he rattles off all those albums in succession, right? You know, his favorite album is Sticky Fingers, and he talks about what he was doing, you know, just about to start college in a few years, you know, in high school. And for me, it's really interesting hearing those stories, but I kind of lack the context because I wasn't there. And so it doesn't put me in the mood, in the element as much as, say, a story like yours does when you just have this perspective saying, you know, we're kind of closer to the end of the road, as you said.
Right. Well, you know, like, it's interesting. My father was not a huge, he did not like this music at all. And he did not even like Elvis. And I used to say to him, you know, I did the math, and I'm like, you're the right age. I mean, you were like 20 years old when Elvis came on the scene. And he always would say, I was too busy making a living, you know? And that also, that gets at something real, which is, you know, sort of the baby boomers suddenly, they had time to do nothing. Whereas up until that generation, there, one of the reasons why there was no rock and roll is because there was no free time. You know, and it's hard for us to imagine a completely different America that was completely remade by this music. And but I do remember that the music he liked was the music you'd think he'd like. I mean, he grew up in Brooklyn. He's like a kid in the 40s, and he was a big Frank Sinatra fan. And I knew that that music was really cool. It wasn't my music, but I knew it was awesome. I mean, I knew that I loved Frank Sinatra, and I knew that there was something very rock and roll about Frank Sinatra. And I feel like there was a handoff, maybe not in the music, but in the attitude. And, you know, there's a point in the book, if you read the book, you know, I sort of make the case that Frank Sinatra and Keith Richards, looked at from a certain perspective, are the same person. You know, I mean, it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but the idea is the same sort of attitude that goes together with the music. And I feel like that lasted through my generation and kind of ended. And that's the context that your father would have that you would be missing if you were, you know, what you are, which is 10 years younger than me.
Yeah, but part of the Stones have this enduring appeal, and that is so much about what you discuss in your story, and it's so much what, you know, Keith Richards alludes to with that, the great quote, which is the title of your book, right? The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. It's like, you know, you count on these things being there day in and day out, but it's so odd in rock and roll to have this kind of longevity. And it's not as if the Stones didn't experience their tragedies. You know, I mean, that's what your book is about. It's really a story of rock and roll survival as much as anything. But I couldn't help but think that even if the Stones stopped, you know, in 1971, 72, I mean, we'd still be regarding them as one of the greatest rock and roll bands of all time, right?
Absolutely. I mean, their golden run, which you mentioned, was pretty much over by 72 in Exile on Main Street. And it's sort of like a question people ask about athletes, which is, you know, is it better to go out after your greatest season when you're still in your prime, or is it better to figure out how to continue on when that prime is past? I mean, it's not a physical issue, but they're artists, and if you look at most great artists, no matter the medium, books, music, you know, paintings, there's usually, for the really good ones, there's a creative stretch where they'll do most of their work. It's depressing to think of, but it ends. And the question is, how do you continue on after that? And you're right, the Stones continued on after that golden run for 30 years or whatever it's been since then. And it's a big mystery, which, you know, why the Beatles broke up in the, I don't know, what, 71 or something, so long ago. And they really had kind of broken up even before that. They just hadn't told anybody. So what keeps the Stones going? There's a lot of things, but everybody I talked to, because I actually did like a huge amount of reporting for this, they all said it was, it's Jagger. And it's his sort of sense of drive and ambition to keep this thing rolling, going down the road. And even when I was really with them, which was like 20 years ago now, I was asking these questions, which is, why do you keep going? And there's basically two reasons Keith Richards could come up with. One was because nobody's taken a rock band this far. So it's interesting just to see how far we can go. Of course, they had a kind of a model, which were their heroes, which are guys like Muddy Waters, who sort of just played forever, you know, until they died, basically. And then the other was because there's one thing that I know, so I think it was a quote he said, and that's the music of this band. And he wanted to play it, and he felt like, you know, the Beatles at a certain point left the road and just worked in the recording studio, and Keith Richards always felt that the music doesn't exist unless it's in front of an audience. And the music is sort of what he's for, and the last element is playing it live, so he's going to keep doing that as long as he can.
But part of you as a fan and must feel as if, you know, this you mentioned athletes, you know, leaving at the top of their game. This kind of has a scent of, you know, Michael Jordan finishing his career with the Washington Wizards, where you have this iconic, all-time great band that is still playing, still rocking out. And for generations of people and fans, the Rolling Stones are, you know, this one latest iteration, this one version, this group of old-timers playing their old hits. And we miss out, I feel, and this is almost a lament of mine, is that we're missing out, I'm missing out, my generation's missing out on the Stones when they were the Stones. We're still getting them, but we're not getting them when they were the Rolling Stones. We just have to instead hear about them through your book, through stories from my father. And I frankly get sad and nostalgic, even though I wasn't there, because I kind of wanted to be there because I wanted to experience it firsthand, like my dad did. But that context, again, is lacking.
Right, and that's just the nature of when you're born. And it's not just the music. It was this idea that, you know, they were changing the world and that it was revolutionary and that they were in the process of discovering something and nobody knew, you know, where the next record would take them. And it was sort of, you know, a movement, like an avant-garde. And that ended, and now you're getting, you know, it's like going to a museum and seeing really great paintings, but they were painted 100 years ago. You know, it's not that thing of, you know, what's going to happen here, and that's just the nature of the rock and roll. And when you were born, I was born too. I kind of, you know, I got it with Springsteen, and I got it with, you know, bands like the Replacements, and there were bands that I felt like were on the verge of figuring something out. But it really kind of ended, and I feel like, but on the other hand, because we're talking about athletes, I actually wrote a story a bunch of years ago for Harper's called In Praise of the Old Athlete, where I kind of made the case, because at that point, I think there was a lot of pressure on Michael Jordan specifically to retire. And I sort of made the case and believe that there's something great about the old athlete who still finds a way to perform even though he's no longer, or she, at the top physical skill and has to find another way to contribute, has to change the game, change their game, because it's almost like it's where they fail and where they come up short that they're the most human. that you can most connect with them, and that they serve as a model for how you get old and how you continue to contribute and do what you love even though you get old. And in that way, the Stones really have done that. I mean, in addition to making tons of money, they show you how you can be 72 years old and still do what you love. You know, and that's valuable to me. So I totally feel you on the other stuff. I mean, I missed it too. You just missed it by a few more years than me, but and we'll never get it back. And hopefully there'll be something to take its place. But you got to kind of appreciate what you have right now, I think.
Yeah, but to continue the argument with the athlete, the past their prime athlete, this analogy I think works on so many levels. I hear what you're saying, you know, about kind of embracing the inevitable aging process, right? That there's a way to age gracefully and still in charge of your life, which is what these athletes and artists are doing. But I mean, it still rankles me that, you know, I was a high school history teacher for 10 years, and I'd have students who would, you know, talk about, you know, their favorite athletes, greatest players, and I'd say, yeah, but you didn't see Jordan. And they'd be like, oh, you know, we saw Jordan when he was, you know, playing for the Wizards, and he didn't seem that great. And it's like, oh boy, no, you have to, let's go back a few years, and you cull up all the old highlights, and the highlights don't do it justice. It's kind of like watching, you know, rockumentaries about the Stones, or watching footage from concerts today from their apex. It's great, and it gives you those goosebumps, but it's not the same as being there and living through it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but what are you going to do unless you can invent a time machine? You know what I mean? That you can't go back. And you're right. That's the weird thing, which is we have all this technology, like, but it doesn't capture it. It doesn't come close to capturing what it's like to be there in the room. And a huge part of any kind of great show is being in the crowd. So, and you, whatever, but it's, but the converse is to say, okay, well, they should stop playing because they're messing up my memory. I just don't think it's right. I think that you're an artist or whatever, but you also have to figure out as a person, like, how you live while you're alive. And one way is, if you love to play rock and roll, you should continue to play rock and roll, and that's what they've done. And they're still great. It's not like they're not. It's just that. And probably as musicians, if you talk to these guys, they're probably better musicians than they've ever been, in a way. Because back in the day, they were kind of sloppy and maybe weren't as great musicians, because when they first came out of the little bars, they were playing to crowds of screaming fans, often like teeny boppers. And so it didn't really matter how well they played, because nobody could hear them anyway, you know? And lately they've become, you know, they play a lot and they play very well. So, but I do know what you mean, but, you know, I liked that Michael Jordan continued on and played. I liked that he was playing after September 11th. I liked, you know, and every now and then you would get a flash. You know, there was a game where he came to Madison Square Garden and he scored 55 points against the Knicks when he was like 38 years old.
Yeah.
Or something. And there's something that I remember, Wayne Gretzky's last game. I remember Gordie Howe. If you go look on YouTube, Gordie Howe at 52 years old scored a goal in the playoffs, like on a backhand shot from the slot, you know, and it's not Gordie Howe as he'd been, and I miss Gordie Howe as he'd been the greatest hockey player ever, maybe, but yet still there's something about the old guy out there playing with the kids that is sort of great.
And I guess,
just, you know what it is? It's just kind of your, like, a taste thing. Like, do you like it or don't you like it, you know?
Yeah. I guess the better sports analogy is to say the Stones now are like that veteran starting pitcher that's lost a few miles per hour on their fastball, but they're equally as effective because they've learned how to pitch over time. You know, they've...
Oh, exactly. Well, that's what Jordan did. Jordan was always an inside player. And then suddenly he had to learn to develop, you know, an outside shot, which wasn't really a huge part of his game. He had to do that to back people off so he can go inside when he wanted to, you know? And there's a lot of really guys who have a lot of talent, and the talent fades or they slow down and they can't figure out a different way to play. That's why the really great guys do figure out, you know, they have to cheat a little bit in some way, or they have to use their intelligence. I remember when I was a kid, this was like a huge thing. I mean, I was watching the Washington Redskins play football, and Joe Theismann was the starting quarterback, and he got hurt. And they brought in their backup, who was Billy Kilmer. And if you look at Billy Kilmer, I think he played like in the 50s. And he had a steel plate in his head from a car crash. And he was fat, and he'd been a great quarterback, but he was old. And just on sheer smarts, he was able to take that team down the field and score. And it was just so impressive to me that you could sort of figure out, without necessarily the physical skills or the moment on your side, how to lead a team. And that had a huge effect on me, and I kind of looked for that everywhere.
Yeah, and that kind of speaks to what you were talking to about kind of appreciating the older athlete, the older rock star, because they're still doing unbelievable things, things that you or I and most people can never imagine accomplishing. And the fact that they're able to do it and still do it is a testament to, you know, something that we don't have. And so therefore it's kind of got to be regarded on a pedestal. One of the things you talk a lot about in your book is how the Rolling Stones, you know, in order to do what they did, they had to be authentic, I think is the word you used, right? You used the word authenticity a lot, that they were...
Well, authenticity was important to them, and of course, the very nature of their project was inauthentic in a way.
Well, right. So I was gonna ask you about that because, you know, so much of where the Stones get their sound and get their inspiration from came from the United States and the Delta Blues and Chicago and things of that nature. You know, you mentioned Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson and artists like that. And I love, you know, as a former history teacher, I just loved that element of your book that really got into how the Rolling Stones were inspired by not just these artists like Muddy Waters, but also by the culture that developed the music in the United States. You know, talking about hundreds of years of oppression and the music that comes from that. And I just thought that was a phenomenal link in the chain of history and music.
Yeah, it's interesting because in a way, we're talking about slavery and the slave trade, and it kind of starts with Great Britain, you know?
Yeah.
And basically, I try to trace the development of this music. And ultimately, this incredible music developed in Chicago. It came from the Mississippi Delta, where it was an acoustic, you know, before the war. They played on acoustic instruments, very rudimentary, just a few chords. And you didn't have to be very amplified because they weren't playing it in very loud places. They came to Chicago, and I always thought it kind of, as it came north, it kind of picked up the steel and the energy and the pace of the cities. And you get to Chicago, and a guy like Muddy Waters, who is similar to Robert Johnson in a lot of ways he played, he plugs in his guitar because he can't be heard, you know, because Chicago's loud and the clubs are loud. So he needs to amplify himself, and he makes this discovery that a lot of guys made, which is electric guitar is not just an acoustic guitar plus electricity, it's a new instrument. And you go from that right to rock and roll, I mean, right to Pete Townsend and everything else. And they made this music, the specific music that I'm thinking about right now. There was a little label in Chicago called Chess Records that was started by a guy named Leonard Chess, who was himself an immigrant from Poland, started out running a junk shop, then ran a liquor store. Then guys would hang out and play, and he started recording it, and he started this label, Chess Records. And basically in Britain, the guys like Mick Jagger heard it on Armed Forces Radio, where black soldiers were listening to it on bases in England after the war, and he just fell in love with it. And now, of course, for him, it didn't have all these racial implications necessarily that it had for, you know, an American. So then Chicago is a super segregated city, and you didn't go down to the South Side to these clubs to listen to this music because there was this racial separation. The perception was that it was dangerous, it was transgressive, and it made a political statement in some way. In Britain, where they didn't have those issues, it was just music. And it was like they picked up the music and they copied it. And that's why I mean inauthentic, because it was a copy. But they weren't attempting to steal it like Pat Boone necessarily. They were attempting to play it so they could listen to it. And then they never originally had the intention of making these huge careers out of it. No one, it was almost like a hobby. But in copying it, they just necessarily changed it, which is what happens when one person with one background copies something else. They make it their own without even meaning to. And then they brought it back to the United States, where it became this huge pop hit by people that didn't even know it was really America's music, just kind of bounced back. And it was always shocking to those, to that generation. There's a famous quote where they asked Paul McCartney, I think, what do you want to see in the United States? And he said, Muddy Waters. And the reporter said, where's that?
Huh.
You know, they had no idea who he was. And they just, they assumed these guys were very famous stars here. Nobody knew who they were. And the funny thing is, you'd think that the guys at Chess would kind of hate the Stones because they'd stolen their music. But really, they recognized, well, they were American guys who took their music and kind of stole it. The Stones, though there was some resentment about the money and everything, they recognized what the Stones were doing was authentic, and that it wasn't exactly a copy. It was something new and something interesting. And it was embraced. So when Howlin' Wolf went to England to tour and he needed a band, I think the Yardbirds played behind him. I mean, they recognized that these were great bands, in some cases as good as the bands on the south side of Chicago.
But eventually the Rolling Stones music becomes representative of not just, you know, generational angst, late 60s, early 70s, but it also becomes kind of the soundtrack for, you know, anti-establishment, combating oppression, you know, ending the Vietnam War, things like that. So in a way, perhaps inadvertently, maybe it wasn't their intent, but in a way they're paying homage to, you know, the early inspiration for these Delta blues. So it does kind of go full circle.
Yeah, well, it all becomes, I guess, kind of a certain kind of protest music, you know. But it became political in a way I don't think it ever was. And the Rolling Stones battled with that, which is they were really plugged into the blues. So, and they always remained so. And I always thought it always saved them. Because the blues is like bedrock. I mean, it's very basic and it's very strong. And if you go back to it, you know, you're going to end up with something. It's like going back to the basics. So, like when the music really got kind of nuts after Sgt. Pepper's by the Beatles, and a lot of bands made these psychedelic songs, and the Stones made kind of a psychedelic record, which is really not a good record, called Satanic Majesty's Request. And they seem like, the Rolling Stone magazine even said at the time, maybe that's the end of the Rolling Stones because this record's so bad, basically, and they seem so lost. Then they went back to the Delta Blues, and they came back with Jumping Jack Flash, which is actually like a Delta Blues song, you know, just sort of turned into a Rolling Stones song. So I do think that the blues was always sort of the thing that kept the Rolling Stones in place and kept them good, really.
What about the personalities involved in the band? Because the band, you know, the Rolling Stones is very much a, I don't know if you can call it, I guess, yeah, you like most bands, you can call it a collaborative effort, but there are always personalities that emerge within the within the collaborative effort. And certainly, you know, the headliners in the Stones, I think most people would agree, are Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. And there, you know, you chronicled that what has now become this piece of rock and roll mythology, this lore, this meeting on Dartford, you know, train station in 1961. You know, how did it happen? When did it happen? You know, who brought
well,
the record?
That is like a piece of lore, and it's like one of the great lores of sort of rock and roll, like along with Robert Johnson going to the crossroads. And it's sort of like, as a writer, how do you approach that? That's like one of the tough ones, because it's been written about a lot.
Yeah.
Even by me. I wrote about it in another book. And you know, people put it in movies, and you sort of look at it. I mean, it's interesting, because I sort of think, what's here that hasn't been said? What's here that's interesting? Now, everything's in it. It's a huge key moment. Everything is in it, because Jagger and Richards had known each other as kids, and then they had separated. And the reason they separated tells you about all the tensions in the band to this day are explained by the reasons they separated, which is, in England they take a test. I think it's called the 11 Ups. I could be wrong about the exact name. But basically it places you. Like, what kind of school are you going to go to for high school? What kind of life are you going to have? Jagger did well on those tests and was put on the track of, you know, the white-collar college kid. He ended up going to the London School of Economics. Keith did not do well on that test, and he wound up in a trade school. And then ultimately, he kind of didn't even show up at the trade school, and they put him in an art school. Because art school then was like, they didn't know what to do with all these kids who previously would have gone into the military for the Empire, for Great Britain. But the Empire was being dismantled after World War II, and they had all these sort of ne'er-do-well kids, and they put them in the art schools. And a lot of the British rock and roll comes out of the art schools. They all went to these art schools. And they didn't see each other. And because of that, there was always this slight resentment, like, you know, Keith was more of a lost blue-collar kid than Mick, who was more of an upper-middle-class kid. And you see that tension even now when Jagger gets knighted, and Keith Richards' response is, when I heard he got knighted, I wanted to cut his throat. You know, it's like a class thing. And then, okay, so then they meet at the railroad, the train, and Jagger's holding a stack of records, famously. Now, the records are interesting because it's Muddy Waters and Chuck Berry, but they're Chess records. He had sent away two Chess records to get these because they weren't in England. He had to send away. And the actual orders were filled out and sent back to him by Marshall Chess, who is Leonard Chess's son and later became like one of the Stones' managers. And Marshall Chess was connected to Leonard Chess and all this stuff. And when the Stones went to Chicago, nobody was allowed to record in the Chess studios except Chess artists. But Marshall Chess got the request and let them record because he remembered them from filling out Michael Jagger's request forms. The other thing is, Mick is holding these records. Keith sees them, is excited about the records. They start talking. It's important that Mick has the records and not Keith because Mick is like the rich kid. And it's a big deal. No one had records. They were poor. So for somebody to have this big stack of records really meant something. And those records, and they started to, Mick and Keith got together that afternoon to listen to those records and started imitating them. And that's the beginning of the Rolling Stones. And I always thought their relationship is sort of symbolic of the fact that they're getting on the train together and they're heading to the city, which is they're going to have this career together, and it's all sort of prefigured in this famous meeting. But it's become so looked at, that meeting, that no one really talks about all the strands in it and what it meant.
It's a great visual. It's a fantastic visual just to think about what that train ride must have been like with those records. And it speaks so much to their individual personalities and how those personalities would go on to shape the Rolling Stones. I was blown away by the fact from your book about, you know, Jagger was enrolled at the London School of Economics and how when the Stones were first getting rolling, they were, no pun intended, sorry, he kept going to classes. They were playing gigs at night, and he would get up. Everyone else was sleeping it off, and he would get up and he would go back to classes. And there was a little bit of resentment that, you know, some of the other bandmates felt that he had, you know, one foot in one world and the other in the other, just in case things didn't work out. And you kind of got behind the curtain, and I don't know if it was in 1994 or if it was in your subsequent work with Jagger on vinyl, but you've been able to see that Mick Jagger, when the curtains are drawn back and he's in a private moment, is still very much that London School of Economics businessman. He's never really lost that tendency or that inclination.
Right. Well, back in, you know, the 60s and the 70s, they got famously, you know, ripped off by Alan Klein, who was their manager, the Beatles manager, and he sort of tricked them. And the result was they didn't have a lot of money, and he had owned their publishing rights because they weren't really very savvy. And it was embarrassing to Jagger, especially because he was known as sort of the smartest rock star because of the London School of Economics. And the fact is that since then, he sort of took very tight control of the band, and he learned from it. And when I saw him, when I first saw him, they brought me in to talk to him the first time I met him. And he was, you know, in a trailer where they were rehearsing in Toronto. And he was just like a business guy on the phone talking numbers and tour stuff and all of that stuff. And it was just, you know, and then in a snap, he suddenly turns to me and he's Mick Jagger. So I do think that, you know, the joke for me is they wanted to live the life, a lot of them, of their heroes, which are these blues musicians. Of course, a big part of that life was getting completely ripped off by the record company. Huh. And that they lived it, but they lived it once and they didn't want to live it twice, you know?
Oh, the irony, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the nature of, it's very hard to be an artist and to sort of have to be completely consumed in creating something and at the same time keeping control of and an eye on all the other little stuff that's going around. You have to kind of leave it to other people. It's like two full-time jobs that require two different kinds of personalities. Like, in one personality, you have to be open, sensitive, you know, ready for all kinds of inspiration, a lot of downtime, you know. And the other one, you have to be kind of suspicious and careful. And so for somebody to be able to do both things, which Jagger's been able to do, is kind of unbelievable. It'd be like running a basketball team and playing on it or something. It's really hard to do both.
And I don't know if this was your intent or not, but I got the sense reading your book that it's very hard to relate to a Mick Jagger because he is this almost this force of nature, this phenomena that doesn't happen very often in this life, and therefore.
Well, also, I think that one of the reasons why it's hard to relate to him is he has this intuitive sense that when you know a lot about somebody, when you feel like you understand them as a person, you're kind of done with them. And that a big part of the mystique of a rock star, a certain kind of rock star, is they're mysterious to you. And so the trick is to seem to reveal a lot about yourself and really reveal nothing. And, I mean, I think Bob Dylan obviously is a master of this. Jagger is and was, and Prince was to some extent. You know, if you were to, I always say as my test, they always say, okay, try to imagine what Keith Richards is doing right now. You might be wrong, but you could say, okay, he's probably playing a guitar and smoking a joint and has a bottle of Jack Daniels next to his side, you know. And I say, try to imagine what Mick Jagger is doing right now. No idea what he's doing right now, you know.
Yeah, but that's why I think in your narrative, I found it easier, if I were going to pick one of those two, I found it easier to relate to the story of Keith Richards, because Keith Richards is... he's got these very visible scars that we can all, to some degree, identify with, and certainly, you know, Jagger has his stories well chronicled, but it's harder to relate to those. Whereas with Richards, it's like you see imperfections in yourself through his experiences, and therefore he becomes a little bit easier to relate to. And I wonder if that. You know, I don't like to do the are you a Jagger or are you a Richards, you know, fan, because that's how people often, you know, look at bands like the Stones and the Beatles, you know, Lennon or McCartney, things like that. I just thought it was interesting in your book.
Well, I think that that's what makes them a great band is it's the combination. It's like the sweet and sour pork, you know. I mean, you can't really, you have them both. That's why they didn't really succeed nearly as much as solo acts as they did as a band, because Keith becomes kind of the point of entry and the easy point of contact, you know, and he's kind of like the floor of the band. I mean, he literally creates the rhythm and starts it with the riff and everything else, and then Mick becomes this kind of mercurial figure that gives you kind of the lead guitar line, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So when people talk about, you know, are they for Keith or for Mick, I mean, I get it, and it's really easy to identify with Keith. I agree with you. But it's like Keith only exists as he does because of Mick.
Yeah.
And vice versa. They exist, their identities exist in relation to each other. So it's like, I don't know, what do you like better? Like, you know, the earth or the sun? You know what I mean? Maybe that's cheesy, but you know what I mean? It's like very hard. The reason why Keith seems so cool is because of his relationship with Mick, and the reason why Mick seems so the way he is because of his relationship with Keith. They're really a package. That's how I see him.
No, I see it that way now too. And I kind of, let's get back to that, the golden run that I was talking about earlier. This succession of unbelievable albums that the Stones produced in the late 60s, early 70s, and I can't be the first to think of this, and you talk about this, but I can't help but wonder how much of that success can be attributed to their reliance on drugs. And would this creative vision and success been capable, would it have happened if it weren't for things like LSD?
I mean, it's interesting. There was a point where Keith, because a lot of bands took a lot of drugs and made a lot of bad music. So taking drugs doesn't mean you're going to make good music. And Keith had a really creepy, was like one of the most famous drug addicts in history, had this really great line I kept thinking of where he said, there's a difference between druggy music and music about drugs. And to them, drugs were so much a culture of that moment, that's something else we missed, where they were seen as kind of this revolutionary thing that was going to change the way people related to each other and cure a lot of the ills of society, and everyone was so excited about it. That was the culture. And that kind of, what happened is those people who took LSD once, then took it 100 times and were completely blown out. And then a lot of them became sort of these waste cases, and they chronicle that. So I think it wasn't so much that the drugs put them in a state of mind where they made this music, as it gave them great subject matter, and it connected them to everybody else at their time. And to some extent, you know, the drugs resulted in a kind of a mood that they were able to chronicle. And even though, you know, Keith became addicted to drugs and other guys in the band, although less, I don't think Jagger ever had a drug problem. Charlie Watts did, but much later and unrelated to this period. Ron Wood wasn't really around then. So I think that almost like the drugs were what the music was about, but they didn't create the music, if that makes sense.
It does. I also think today we have a way of, it sounds ridiculous, but we have a way of mythologizing this drug abuse and use, right? And it's almost like part of the legend of...
Right, but they did it too, you know, because the guys who were their heroes, like a lot of the old jazz musicians, they were addicted to heroin. You know, and you'd listen to a guy like Charlie Parker or whatever, or Coltrane, know about his problems. And you'd think necessarily that somehow the drugs enabled him to get to a place where he could write that music. And it tempted them just like it tempts us, I think.
You can say that, I mean, the same can be said about any kind of, you know, artist. You know, you talk about writers, and there are those, you know, stories about, you know, Ernest Hemingway. I mean, go you just name them, right? That all of these ideas come from reliance on substances and
right. But Hemingway is a good example, because Hemingway, you know, alcohol kind of destroyed his ability to write. You know, so it was just, he was, I don't think he took anything but liquor, Hemingway. But he, you know, it's not a good story for him, because he wrote a lot before he drank a lot, and then as he drank, he wrote less and less.
And the drug abuse and use, though, what does make it so compelling in the case of the Rolling Stones is that it ultimately is, to kind of circle back, it is a story about longevity and survival. So it's amazing that these guys, in large part, have survived as long as they have, considering...
Right, remember, they didn't all survive.
Right, I know, I was going to say that, yeah.
Yeah, hugely musically important, and he died.
Right.
It was really drugs that killed him.
Well, I had no idea, for instance, that Brian Jones was kind of the band leader at the start, right?
He started the band. It was his idea. He put the ad in the paper. He recruited them. He staffed it up. He chose the set list. He would speak between the songs. Go look at the early publicity shots. He's in the middle. He's the leader.
Yeah.
And then he slowly lost control to Jagger just by the natural occurrence of, as the band got popular, newer fans who didn't maybe understand everything that was making the music go on actually, you know, would relate to the lead singer, which is just what happens every time. It wasn't anybody's fault. It's just a natural way people experience music. And then he, you know, but the main thing that really caused him to lose control was when Jagger and Richard started writing songs together, because that determined everything, you know, what the band was going to sound like, what their identity was going to be, and also, you know, the money. Because the money would ultimately be in the songwriting more than anything else.
Do you know what the Rolling Stones think about music today? Have they ever weighed in publicly on what they think about this? Not necessarily the music industry. I'd rather know about what they just think about where the quality of music or the type of music is currently. I wonder if they're on record as to weighing in on that.
I've never heard specifically about the music right at this exact moment, but I can tell you that one of the really great things about Jagger that's kept him young is he's always been very open to what's going on the top 10, the top 40 at any given moment, and I'm sure that is still the case. So whereas Keith is sort of more buried, you know, sort of settled in the tradition, and the people that are playing with that tradition. And it's that, that's the pull. That's why it's a great band. So a very clear example, you know, was in the 70s where Mick got really into disco and Keith resisted that and was into the blues, and you get Some Girls, which is kind of a blues, disco blues album, you know?
Yeah.
And, and even when I was around with them, Jagger would go out to clubs just to hear what was on, they were playing at clubs, and just to see what people were reacting to on the dance floor. Whereas Keith would sort of stay back and hang out and listen to reggae and have people come play with them. Completely different way. One's kind of open to the world and looking for new inspiration, and the other kind of knows what they like and is playing with that.
Yet, as you said, you put them together and you have the makings of an all-time great rock and roll band.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, I'll get you out on this one. And thank you so much for chatting with me this little while. You're a Chicago guy, so I know you've written about the Bears before. So I've got to ask, I'm not going to ask you to compare the Stones to the Beatles, because everyone does that. Instead, what I'm going to ask you to do is to compare the Stones to the 1985 Chicago Bears. So I need to find a Mike Singletary, a Richard Dent, a Walter Payton, a Jim McMahon. You see where I'm going with this. Do you think you could draw some parallels for us?
Well, I think that, first of all, the reliance, especially in the early Stones, on amphetamines, you know, drop your reds, drop your greens and blues, and go with the 85 Bears, specifically McMahon, who told me about there being giant jugs of pills in the locker room, and his favorite was called Uptimes. And I think the ability, the thing about the Bears is they would completely shock other teams by blitzing everybody and attempting to knock you out on every single play. And I think that's similar to the way the Stones play, so I can make that. But the difference is the Bears were more like one of those bands that kind of like let success, early success, destroy them. So, you know, I always said, like, after the Bears won the Super Bowl, I think 22 guys on the roster opened bars. So they completely lost their focus, and they became, you know, nightlife creatures, and they forgot to go to practice, and they never won again. Whereas the Stones, even though they went nuts now and then, were always able to pull it back together and make another record. So they're, in a way, more like the 49ers, I would say, or like the Pittsburgh Steelers, because, you know, winning championships over a span of like 12 years in the NFL is probably the equivalent of, you know, continuing on the road with hits for 60 years for the Stones. That's how much more brutal the NFL is in the rock and roll life. So I think that what's amazing about the Bears are almost more like a one-hit wonder. You know, if you could think of some band with one unbelievably greatest hit of all time and then sort of became completely addicted and vanished, that's kind of more like what happened to the 85 Bears.
I tried. I thought you did a pretty good job there. I tried.
I tried too. I was
trying to draw those parallels. Rich, thanks for taking the time and best of luck with your book and everything else.
All right, thanks. Great talking to you.
That's it for this edition of the Passport Play Podcast. My thanks once again to Rich Cohen, whose new book, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, is available online and at a bookstore near you. Don't forget to subscribe to the Passport Play Podcast on iTunes or by visiting passportplay.tumblr.com. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again soon.